I've enjoyed playing here. This has been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. This way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great, but the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath and Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
Welcome back to Australian Golf Passport. I'm Scott Warren, and as always, I've got Matty Mollica with me. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Scott. Good to speak with you again. Another good episode queued up and ready to go with Ben Hillard. Lots of great stuff that we addressed with him a couple of weeks back. We've polished it up and done a little bit of editing and now ready to share it with the listeners and really looking forward to their feedback on it.
Yeah, it was super to chat to an Aussie boy made good. Hear a little bit about his story. He's someone who's been involved in a lot of the kind of high-profile renovation work and some new build courses that are very exciting. And working under Gil Hance, of course, doesn't get a lot of PR himself, but does incredible work and has a great story to tell.
Yeah, and particularly interesting for a lot of us with the work about to commence at Royal Sydney. So he fleshes a little bit of that out. That's been a topic that's been on our minds and obviously the minds of some of our listeners for a while now as well. So good to get a bit of an update on planned works there and how that project might unfold.
That's a month away now. They're going to start work on that, killing the grass and getting stuck in pretty quickly to that job. It kind of segues into the news of the week a little bit that New South Wales Golf Club members have been reviewing the master plan from Mackenzie and Ebert to redesign that golf course. Ideally, that'll happen next summer, so 24-25, shut down for the whole summer and do 18 holes all in one go. Really excited about what that plan has in it. There's a little bit of detail, I think, to finalise, but addresses a lot of the things that people have talked a lot about New South over the years, the severity of some greens and green complexes, 17 and 2, great examples. It addresses that middle paddock that's just kind of these acres of couch grass fairways and couch rough, bringing in some sandy waste and creating a bit more playing strategy and visual interest there, breaking up the holes a bit. And also, I think the sixth hole has always been, the setting has always far outweighed the hole itself. And exciting to see the plan that they have to try and, as they say, it's got a setting that matches 16 at Cypress Point or 14 at Monterey Peninsula. So let's create a hole that fits that setting. And I think they're well on the way to doing that. So super exciting to see that progressing. Going to be a big couple of years in Sydney. Going to be competitive for tee times at the clubs that aren't closed down. And can't come along soon enough. And then in Melbourne, Matty, we've also been tracking the redesign of Commonwealth Golf Club by Renaissance Golf Design. Of course, they had the front nine open earlier this year and got word this week that they're going to be starting the second nine holes, so the southern half of their property. They'll be starting that on the 20th of August, so a couple of days away.
Yeah, that's really exciting. The word from people who've played those reworked holes on the northern half of the course has been very positive. The visuals are really positive. And if that trend continues and they restore some luster to that course, that'd be fantastic. Probably just continues the trend of some good work at Yarra Yarra over the previous 12 to 24 months. And then before we know it, that Commonwealth work will be finished and OCM will be starting to do some work on Huntingdale. So things never stand still.
No. Let's not waste too much time before we get into the main event. Anything else on your mind?
The No Laying Up collab with Angus and Grace. That's probably at the forefront of the ad read thoughts. Some great stuff, some hats, some beautiful big dog head covers, towels, tees. Matt's done some great work there. I'm not sure how much stock you'll have left.
Has your little care package arrived yet?
It has.
How good is the t-shirt?
It's fantastic. Yeah.
I got it home and I showed my wife and she felt it. She's like, that's a really, really good t-shirt. Like just the material is, people hear t-shirt and I think they think disposable, cheap article of clothing. I was really struck by that, by the texture of the bubble print. It's a really, really great, as always, as you would expect from Matt and from Angus and Grace, really high quality stuff at a competitive price for the quality of what it is. And yeah, the hats as well. He's even got a hat that fits on my gigantic dome, which is not super reliable that that will happen. So yeah, happy camper here.
Yeah, he's done a great job there. That quality that we associate with everything he does just carries through. So if you've not had a look at that online and you've ummed and ahed about pushing go on the cart with NLU in times past, domestic pricing makes it much easier and the quality has never been better than what Matt's done. So venture across and have a look.
And I'll note to people, jump on his website and have a look. The original line of bamboo polos that Matt did, he's got a sale running on those at the moment on his website, both short sleeve and long sleeve, and they're really striking, lovely Australian climate targeted wear. So have a look. Really great price on those on sale. Of course, it's angusandgracegogolfing.com. It's Angus and Grace Go Golfing on Instagram, and it's Angus and Grace Go Golfing on William Street in Paddington in Sydney.
Brilliant. All right, let's get into it. The main fair, Ben Hillard from Gilhance Golf Design.
When the job starts, you know, you guys can hopefully set up some conversations with Gil or Josh and Reese and just kind of like update people what's going on. Because I don't think golf course construction is really talked about a lot. I think people talk about golf architecture and it's amazing and in-depth and everyone wants to get into it. But construction is a whole different world in its own. And I think, you know, some people really enjoy it. Some people aren't interested and that's fine too. But, you know, it's what gets me out of bed every morning thinking about how I'm going to solve problems. So.
Yeah.
Hopefully you guys can chat about it as the project happens too. We'll get you a shovel and a rake. You'll be set.
You know what? I would love to go and just like dig some holes. And I did a little bit of that with Mike Cocking and Ashley Mead when they were doing Body Dune. I was a member there then. And it's just so interesting and fun. And it lets you understand, as you just kind of said, you know, everyone's keen on the design and the drawings and the pretty stuff, but it's, I can't remember which architect it was that said that golf design was making drainage look good. But like, you really do, you know, when it doesn't function properly, you can see it not functioning properly. So it's really cool to see how much, you know, boring stuff actually underpins the stuff that you see.
Yeah, I find it fascinating how much time we think about not the pretty lines and the pretty bunkers. We spend so much of our time understanding how to make something function, how to make it work, maintainable, accessible, make it all flow. And then you get to focus that last 20% of your time on getting the details and getting everything like exactly how you want it. But if you can't get it to function, it's never going to work.
Yeah. And so growing up in Melbourne, does Ben Hillard dream of being a golf course designer, or is that something that comes after?
Definitely not. You know, I played golf a very little bit when I was young. My dad played golf and I kind of followed him around a little bit. I had to cut down 7-iron around like Anglesey Golf Club when we're out on the back holes and out of everyone's way. But, you know, aside from hitting the golf ball in the backyard a little bit, I didn't really play golf much until I was 21. And then I kind of just like devoured golf and played golf every day whilst I was supposed to be studying. And I was doing landscape architecture at the time at Melbourne University, and we did one homework assignment, like 1 week in that whole 4 years, where we did design a golf hole. And that was like this light bulb moment in my head. And it was about the same time that I had been down to Barmbougle for the first time and, you know, had some friends who were involved at Barmbougle, and I was like, wait, you can do this? And, you know, that was kind of like that's it. This is what I'm doing every day. And yeah, it was pretty late to me that I realized that you could do it for a living. But really, it's just been like, this is really exciting. I want to learn about it. I want to do it. I want to follow whoever will let me get dirty and get in the holes and figure that stuff out. So that's kind of been the journey for a while now.
And so the time you spent working on maintenance crews, on greenkeeping crews, that was a deliberate sort of the path towards doing the exciting stuff was to learn the fundamentals of managing a golf course. And
yeah, I think it's one of those things that's like actually worked out really well, but I graduated university right in the financial crisis. So I wanted to get into golf course design and construction straight away, but there was just nothing happening like anywhere in the world, especially not in Australia. And so you know, I spoke to a few people and they just sort of said, "What, you know, go do maintenance." And you know, so I went to the golf course where I was playing at the time, Rosanna, and you know, Dean was like, "Yeah, great, you know, we'll help you out. You can learn how to mow greens and fairways." And I got a job at St. Andrews in Scotland as a seasonal turf guy, just because I wanted to see the world and try and see it through turf, because it could be a progression. And it turned out that all that time I spent was just an amazing education in how golf courses function and how what they need to work and how maintenance works. I definitely wouldn't say I'm a superintendent by any means, but you know, spending time around superintendents and crews and understanding what mowers can and can't do was like that's beneficial. I pull from those memories every single day in when we're shaping and building, like figuring things out.
And then was it your time after St. Andrews at Cabot that kind of gave you that transition point to actually participate in building a golf course?
Yeah. Yeah. So I spent two extended seasons, I'd say, at Cabot. You know, the first one was I worked there to work a grow-in. So we worked on the grow-in and getting ready for opening of the Lynx course, which is the first course they open. And then I went back the second year knowing that they were going to be working construction on the Cliffs course. And I went back to work turf again, hoping that I could sort of just get up there and be around the construction and just try and absorb it. And I think being there and being eager enough, Keith Reb and the guys were just so great that like, just come on up, you know, we'll find you stuff to do. And I managed to transition to construction then, which was awesome. And just to be around that and I got to spend a little bit of time with almost everybody on that crew and just sort of see how they took it differently and what jobs they were doing. And it was the best. Like you're just so excited because I really wanted to be in this, and everyone around was just, you know, open and gracious and wanting to share and give me a shot, which was cool too. Like, you want to run an excavator, jump in it, go play around, move that pile over there and see what happens. And I had all the time in the world, so I just did as much as I could.
Core Crenshaw on the ocean isn't a bad place to start, is it?
They don't miss. they don't miss. He's the best. You know, I mean, he's get all these amazing sites and they just do such good work time after time after time. And, you know, I was allowed to sort of walk with Bill and the team when they kind of walk through and just sort of observe and then edit their work, and just listening to the dialogue about how they look at broad scale and then fine tune everything down to looking at minute details is just really amazing to be a part of, and just understand the machinations of how their process was. You know, and this is before I'd really even spoken to Gil or Jim. So that was my first introduction. It's like, well, that's probably, you know, you're starting at the right place if you're, you know, being involved with sort of these guys and around them. And yeah, understanding their passion, I think, was really important too. Like, they obsessed about details. They cared about everything, and nothing was just good enough. It was always like, we got to get that right. And I think that was, you know, really kind of inspiring to be around and motivating. So,
do you see many differences between the way that Ben worked back then and what you and your crew do with Gil and Jim these days?
Yeah, I mean, there's differences about how crews go about doing things and the way that they set landforms up or the way that they, you know, prepare things. And there's like minute details, like, you know, Bill might like his bunkers to have a certain look, whereas Gil and Jim might prefer theirs to be a little different. But, you know, it's the same philosophy, I think, but like the way they go about it can be quite different, and that's like fascinating in itself, you know. And like, does one person set the table for the next person to go in and take it further, or does one person own a hole and they take that hole through to completion and sort of have the freedom? And, you know, neither is right or wrong. But one thing that I think that they both do well is like understanding the editing process and like being okay to like look at something, review it. And if you need to tinker with it, like, it's okay. It's okay to go in and change it. And like, oh, this isn't really working. What do you think? And like, all right, let's do that. I think everybody kind of does this different because construction is such a different process and every site is different. So it's like how you adapt to the site almost dictates how you build it. And so, you know, maybe building a golf course in St. Lucia is totally different to the experience we had at Cabot and Lost Farm, you know, compared to what we have at a Hoopy or, you know, here in Nashville. It's just how you react to the site changes almost the entire construction process. which I think is pretty cool too.
With the work that you do week in, week out, do you have a preference for greenfield sites or restoration?
I don't know if I really have a strict preference. They're very different world. You know, restoration, you have, you know, you have a path kind of set for you by somebody else. You know, like, this is what Ross did or Rainer did or Tillinghast did, and you're like, all right, how do I put this back and make it work for what superintendent needs? Is that possible? Is it still possible with the land we have left? You know, and I think that is like a puzzle that you have to figure out. And then when you're doing a new build, it's like you create your own path. And so you're like, you know, you can build your own puzzle and solve it for yourself, essentially. You know, the interesting thing with new builds is that you can take the whole ballpark to make your concept work. Whereas if you're doing restoration, the superintendent and the team is like small, like don't disturb any more than you have to. So you're kind of almost always kind of working within a box to do the best job you can. Whereas, you know, you could be on a new build and be like, let's just move the green 30 yards that way. And that's something you can do on a Tuesday if you want to. So it's just different. It's a different kind of muscle to work, I guess. But I think that doing restoration work has made me better at the new build stuff. Like learning from the golden age architects and like studying their golf courses and really analyzing how they got to places has made me better at solving problems in the new build world. I think that's like been a really enjoyable thing. Like every time we do a restoration, you just have a bigger toolkit that you can work off of.
It seems that building a new course too could be a bit like when you're in high school and your English teacher says, write a 500-word story about anything you want. And you're like, well, what am I going to write about? Whereas, you know, the restoration's like, write a story about someone you work with. And it just immediately focuses you on a contained mission.
Yeah.
I can imagine getting 150, 200 great acres of land, you know, the possibilities being endless might not always be a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember who said it, but like problems make great golf holes. Like, figuring out how to solve something can often make a great golf hole. It's like, if you've got the blank canvas, that's really hard. But if you've got, well, this piece of land kind of tells us we have to go this way. It's like, all right, cool. This is my parameters. You know, I can work with that. And I think that, you know, where on the new builds, we have like these really quirky, you know, features. It's like sometimes when we're just working with something we found in the ground, you're like, oh, that's cool. Let's keep it. Like, don't touch that. Now we'll figure out the rest of this golf hole. And, you know, to be honest, I think that's like some of the really fun stuff when you have these quirky problems you're trying to solve. And that's when the unique elements of golf courses really come to life, is when like, oh, there's this random rock wall that we found. It's like, well, what happens if we put the green behind it or in front of it? And, you know, you use those anchoring points to design off of. And I think that's where the fun stuff really, you know, you have to play around with it. You can build some cool stuff. Yeah. And like on the restoration side, like you're like, this once existed. How do I put that back? And if everything makes sense, I should be able to restore it if nothing has changed. And that's, you know, that's a different kind of problem, but it's a fun one too. It's like, well, that mound just shouldn't be there. That should just be filled dirt and just take that away. Yeah, that's kind of a wafting answer. I apologize for that, but
no, not at all.
Wafting, I remember, answers are the best answers.
I remember, Ben, when we first met, you were talking about almost a forensic type of construction you were doing, I think, on a course in Tokyo where bunkers had been filled out and you were on an excavator working through levels of what was new soil used to fill a hazard and what was remnant soil that defined the margins of a hazard. And you could basically just scrape away what was fill and leave what was there prior. And I was yeah, fascinated that you had such precision with such heavy equipment that you were able to see such a clear delineation. Yeah, it was remarkable.
Yeah, I think it was talking about a job in Brazil working at this club called Gavia Golf and Country Club, and really cool little project that we were doing alongside the Olympic course. But yeah, we were really like being archaeologists. Like you're experimenting like by digging down. And sometimes if we're really lucky, when somebody fills in a bunker, they kind of get lazy when they do it, and they don't take all the sand out and they just put dirt on top of sand. And then if you're digging out with an excavator, you'll almost get to the point where if you hit it gently enough, that dirt will just slide straight off the sand. And you can literally trace the entire bunker by where the sand has been left when they filled it back in. And then you just very carefully and diligently go around it. It's amazing how accurate you can be by just what was in the ground. You don't even have to guess. You're just like, well, that's the old sand. We know we're right. So let's just follow that. And it went in here. So let's just finish that off. And, you know, a lot of projects we've done, we have been able to carry out some like archaeological stuff in the field to like, to back up our like thesis on restoration. It's really fun. Like the archaeology part is like awesome. Cool. Plus digging up sand that hasn't been played off of for like, a, you know, 80 years or 100 years is always pretty, pretty cool.
Mm. And so let's stay in Brazil, because I did want to ask you about the Olympic course. It's, you know, it's not, I guess, just a golf course because of its role when it was built, you know, in trying to grow the game, in actually grow the game, not grow the game the way that most people talk about growing the game, in a country where, you know, it didn't really have a strong foothold. People talked about the fact that this thing's going to disappear after the Olympics. It's such a waste of money. It's a white elephant. It's still going strong. I think it's doing, you know, about 60,000 rounds a year now between tourists and locals. It must be pretty cool to have contributed to something that's significant in a way that, you know, you can build a new course in the US and it's a new course in the US, but doesn't necessarily change the game in that country. That must be, you know, experience that was pretty special.
Yeah. I have so many fond memories about that project. It was the first project I had with Gil and Jim, and I'm stoked that they gave me a shot. But what was also amazing is just the level of conversation that we were having amongst our team, from like the infield design side of things. You know, we'd be talking about, all right, well, here comes Bubba Watson, he's going to hit this tee shot, and how are we going to, what are we going to ask him to do? But then we're also flipping the switch to like, he's the rank beginner who's never seen a golf course before. How do we have them enjoy golf in Brazil? Because it's not publicly accessible in Brazil at all. And this was a really big opportunity. And, you know, there was an element of like, this could be someone's first ever experience on a golf course. How do we want them to see golf, experience golf, play golf? How do we make it as fun as possible so they'll want to do it again? So it's like having conversations literally within like a minute of each other on the complete spectrum of like golf ability all day long, and like tiring, mentally exhausting, but also really stimulating at the same time. And yeah, the fact that it's still open and, you know, people are playing it. And, you know, last time I was there, it's a few years back, but I went back and played it, and there was kids running around. There were, you know, golfers from other clubs in town. And it just, yeah, it was just really great to see. And I hope they stay open. I hope they keep doing, you know, they do really well, because unfortunately not many other venues are still going down there, and it's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I was reading that COVID actually was an absolute boon for the Olympic course, because all the private clubs in Rio shut down through the worst of the pandemic there, but the Olympic course stayed open. And so all the private club golfers just started playing the Olympic course, and sort of really, you know, and even once their clubs are open again, you know, I guess a testament to what you guys built, a lot of them are still including rounds there, you know, in their rotation, because it's so much fun. So yeah, it's a really cool result.
Thanks. I mean, it makes me happy to hear. I didn't really know that much about that part of it, but it's cool. And I think it's a really pleasant place to play golf. The walk is very easy. It's relatively flat. You know, some of the golf courses in the city are very hilly and very, very tough. So, you know, stoked that people are playing it and enjoying it and want to go back for more, especially people have options to play elsewhere. That's about as good a compliment as you can get, right?
When you talk about world-class golf that touring pros can be challenged by, but that newcomers can enjoy and not be overwhelmed by, you know, the Sandbelt, I guess, features, and particularly Royal Melbourne West. And I understand that, you know, that was sort of an inspiration for what you built in Rio, and the crew all came to Melbourne and sort of had a bit of a study tour before they went there to build?
You know, trying to draw some inspiration from the Sandbelt was definitely a driving force of the design, you know. And then, you know, I was not part of the team at that point, but yeah, Gil and Jim and Neil Cameron all spent a good chunk of time in Melbourne just sort of studying the Sandbelt, getting the feel for it and understanding, you know, how, what makes the Sandbelt great. And it's not just certain things, there's so many facets to it. And then, yeah, drew a lot from that in the process of building it and like constantly tinkering with it. And, you know, me being from Melbourne, I guess that gave me a little bit of an inside track to go help and build bunkers and try and get some aesthetics sort of like relating to Sandbelt golf. It's, you know, it's not the same. Those bunkers are not the same as, you know, Royal Melbourne bunkers, but we tried to sort of make it feel like there was a bit of a connection there. But we also just worked really hard on trying to get the native transitions and like make it feel like, you know, the native grasses and environment sort of transitioned into the golf course really well. And that's one thing that I think the Sandbelt does maybe better than anywhere else in the world. And I think that's, you know, if anyone can learn one thing from the Sandbelt, the millions of things you can learn, but looking at how those bunkers turn into native grasses, into tree canopy, and it all sort of like tapers up. And I think that's amazing. And everywhere should be doing it if they can.
Remarkable how time flies. I remember Clates talking about walking around Commonwealth with Gil and getting ready to embark on that Olympic course project. And those Rio Games were 7 years ago this month.
Yeah.
I remember the chat on Golf Club Atlas when the IOC had, I think, a final eight firms from which to select, and Doak was there and Norman was there and Tomo and Kari Webb, and Gil was relatively unknown then, and I think he was a bit of a surprise selection. But it's really been in some ways a springboard for him and led to innumerable great jobs.
It's interesting too, yeah. that same trip, Matty Clates tells the story about walking around Victoria Golf Club with Gil. And Gil had never been to the Sandbelt before. Yeah, he'd probably seen pictures and whatnot, but had never actually been there in the flesh. And they're walking around Victoria and they walk up off 11 and down the 12th hole. And Mike says, as soon as they turned the dog leg and Gil saw that green, he said, well, that's not an original green. And absolutely it wasn't. It was one of the, obviously, the few that had been touched up pretty significantly. It's remarkable. Yes, it's hard work. And yes, it's a lot of things that a lot of people can do if they apply themselves. But I think people like Gil, you know, Tom, Bill and Ben just seem to have this innate understanding of what they're looking at. And I think that, you know, you could walk a million golfers around and ask them to identify the new greens and you'd probably have every green on the course named. But yeah, he just immediately eyeballed that green and was like, nah, that's not right.
We're all just shaking
our heads. I mean, I'm sure he loves that story. If you know, keep telling that as much as you want to make it happen. Obviously I wasn't there, but I think one thing that Tom and Bill and Gil and Jim, and the design build element of what we do, I think knowing how to build something, knowing what goes into building it, kind of gives you just another level of appreciation for when you're seeing golf courses. And like, you know, one thing that I have found in my experience, and not to take too much of it, but after I learned to shape, I look at golf courses entirely differently. Like, how would I recreate that shape? Is that shape that's very easy to create? Is that a difficult shape to create? And those sort of things, like, you know, catch your eye very quickly. And I think that's very cool, but it's very detrimental to my golf game because I get very sidetracked by things and want to play a lie out of them and over them and all that sort of stuff all the time. So,
don't know exactly how to word this, but are irregular shapes harder to create than you often see on golf courses that have been built in a sort of very quick and fast, maybe cheap fashion? You see a lot of the same shape replicated, you know, the chocolate drop type shapes, or around greens where they want water to leave the green, there'll be maybe three rolls, but they're all exactly the same shape and size. Is that, I mean, it would seem to me that building anything should be as hard as building anything, and that why don't they just build interesting, irregular, natural looking shapes? But is that, what's the trick or the magic in building that really natural looking stuff that a lot of golf courses don't seem to nail?
Well, I think first off, it's got to be intent. it's not to knock on anyone who built golf courses in the past, but like, you know, if the primary focus is not necessarily to build the most beautiful golf course in the natural setting, like that's okay. But, you know, you're not focused on that from day one. But I also think like just spending time outside, spending time looking at things. And then one thing you have to really work on, well, I feel like I have to work on, is like you spend a lot of time getting really good at working in a machine, and it might be a bulldozer, and you get really good at making these nice big rolls, and then you almost have to unlearn that to break those natural shapes up, that like that piece of equipment is very good at making this size a contour or this size a mound. And so it's like you almost have to, like, you want to build it, and then you're like, wait, now I need to go and undo that a little bit to like add those like natural quirks. And I mean, an easy example is like everyone sort of knows like a mini excavator or an excavator. They've got an arm and then they swivel on a center point, so it's quite easy to make the same radius turn all the time. What's hard is to like break that habit and move the machine constantly, so you're not making constant arcs. You're changing the curves and taking it out of the machine dominated sort of scale and breaking that up. And that takes a lot of time to sort of like learn how to do and control. And when it's done well, it's imperceptible from nature. But yeah, I think when you start to see patterns, that's when your eye picks up on those patterns and you're like, oh, wait, this doesn't quite look right to me. And then, you know, like you talk about, you start to see all these chocolate drops and, well, you've noticed like, well, they're all the same shape. Your brain's figured that out for you. So, yeah.
One of the main reasons we were so keen to speak with you, Ben, was the schedule of upcoming work at Royal Sydney, which your firm is about to embark on. We talked about it a tiny bit prior to hitting the record button. Royal Sydney's had this on the horizon for a while, and they're, as Scott mentioned, they're getting rid of their grass coverage in the coming weeks, is it, Scott?
Yeah, September, I think they're poisoning the grass.
Okay.
Well, Ben would know probably better than I, but that's what I've heard.
And then things obviously really take off from there. We've got a great route plan for the proposed new course that we'll put up as a bit of a guide for people who are interested in what Royal Sydney will end up looking like. That's a project that you'll have a little bit to do with amongst all of your other work in the next 18 months in the northeast of the US.
Yeah. You know, I'm really excited for the Royal Sydney project. It's a project that I've been, you know, pretty heavily involved in with Gil and Jim, you know, since the initial communications with the club. And yeah, it's been a little bit of a long time coming, but I think, you know, one thing that I think is really important is to kind of acknowledge that it's well done by the membership and the leadership to like not rush this. They want to get it right. And if something's not working, like they're going to figure out how to get it right and not sort of jump into it too early, which I think is hard to do as a club. Yes, it's taken a while, but I think we're very excited to sort of get into it and get into it in a situation where the club's comfortable with where the golf course can go and we're comfortable with where the golf course can go and the community is, you know, okay with where the golf course can go, and rather than going into it with like, you know, people being with different expectations. So, you know, I think that's a really important part of getting the project where it is now. And I think overall, I think it's a great opportunity for, you know, the club to kind of really change the character of the golf course. There's some pretty significant design change, and then there's some areas that aren't being changed that much. And so it's going to be a very, you know, exciting project to get into. I really am looking forward to sinking my bucket in somewhere and trying to make some pretty holes and help the guys out shaping it.
Interesting case study in, you know, we talked previously about restorations and renovations versus greenfield. And I think seems to me one of the key differences in a practical sense is a greenfield project, you probably have between 1 and 5 clients, and on a renovation, you know, club in the US, you might have 300 or 400. Club in Australia, you might have 800. Royal Sydney, I think, has playing golf members into the thousands. Getting that consensus, and you talked about it, you referenced it in your previous answer, getting a consensus around what's the goal and the mission and what does success look like, that the club executive, the architects who are putting their name to the work, and all of the members who feel, you know, and rightfully feel hugely invested in the outcome, that's a tricky thing, right? And that it can take time. And I know with Royal Sydney, that involved a few revisions of the plan that maybe diluted Gil's and Jim's and your own creative vision with that first version that you put out that had, for instance, the par three finisher. But I guess the question in this kind of ramble, so everyone can ramble on this podcast, not just our guests. The question in that is, how critical is that to an outcome that everyone feels good about? Or you could build the most pure version of what you saw and all of the beard pullers out there among us could say, oh my God, that's incredible. But I guess if the members don't feel like it's success and it's what they wanted and it speaks to them, it's kind of a failure in a way.
Yeah. I think the best way to try and put it together is like what you're really searching for in a project is buy-in. You want everybody to buy into what you're doing. So you want the architect to be, you know, maybe leading the design side of things, but you want the club to be buying into what the architect wants, the superintendent to be on the same page as everybody else. And, you know, yes, there's external community factors and they need to be buying into this as well because it's in their neighborhood. So the more buy-in you can get, that really is going to lead to the best possible success. Because if everyone's on board, everybody understands what we're trying to achieve and what we're trying to build and how the superintendent's going to maintain it and what's going to happen to the property and the experience, then that's your real path to success. You know? And yes, there'll be criticisms. There's always criticisms. There's certain holes or features or, you know, not everyone's going to love every golf course that's built. In fact, if everybody loves it, you know, as they say, you've probably done it wrong. And so that's fine. But I think the patience to try and get the buy-in right and everybody on the same page has been a really important step for the club. You know, and if the initial versions of the design, there are some different concepts from what we will end up building, but that's okay. You know, you can go to an architect and say, like, treat this as a blank canvas, what would you do? And then it's okay to cherry pick and have, you know, discourse and conversation. Like, we don't think that's going to work for us. I'm like, okay, great. Mm. Let's go to the next option. And, you know, as long as you still feel like you have the opportunity to create something that could be enjoyable and challenging and hit all the right, tick all the right boxes that we're trying to do, then we're on the right path. And I think that's been really the process with Royal Sydney. And, you know, we have, I think, a great opportunity to work with the club and create something special.
When you're coming up with the initial plan for a job like Royal Sydney, and let's use the par three finisher that was suggested at Royal Sydney as an example. Do you sometimes, will you have conversations where it's like, club probably won't go for this, but we're gonna throw it all in here, and we expect this feature or that hole or this decision might get a red cross through it, but like bugger it, let's give them the pure vision, even if we don't expect that to necessarily all be accepted.
I think, you know, I think if Gil was answering this question and Jim was answering this question, I think it was, we were asked to present what we think could be the best set of golf holes for this property. And we saw an opportunity. You could have, you know, I know there's a picture out there somewhere. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but you could have a great medium length par three with that clubhouse as the backdrop as your finishing hole could look something like Royal Melbourne 5. That's like, that would be very compelling to build, and it could be the best finishing hole in Australia, you know, and we thought that was a great opportunity. The club wasn't on board with that, and that's okay, you know, but we tried to take it in the full question and not, it's not so much like we're going to throw this out there so we can have the leverage and concede that. It was just, what do you think could be the best out of this piece of land? And that seemed to be a great opportunity. It's not for that client, and that's fine.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Royal Sydney is such an incredible opportunity for you guys as the firm's first job in Australia. Well, great soil in a great location. There's some good land. The club has the means to do the final 10%, 5%, 1% the right way. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty incredible way to kind of be able to announce yourself in this country. And the room for improvement, with no disrespect at all to Royal Sydney or to Ross Watson, the course that's there now versus what that site could potentially yield, it feels like the perfect opportunity for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've always been excited about working at Royal Sydney. It's a great club, and you know, we've had a really good relationship with them, and we're excited to get into it. And I think, you know, being able to discuss like a very different approach to what that golf course will look like, you know, and the club being on board with it, I think has been really exciting, you know, and the biodiversity option, you know, opportunity for that aesthetic. And like, you know, the current golf course, you know, there's sections of the property where it's kind of a little bit back and forth and a little bit straight lines, and to try and, you know, break up those lines, but then also completely overhaul the plant palette and the aesthetic of the golf course to create thousands of different shrubs and grass varieties and trees, and, you know, encourage that birds and insects and bugs and all that come back to that golf course, because it is an important little corridor for the wildlife. And I think that presents a great opportunity for Australian golf too, to see that this golf courses can look like this, and they can have a heathland look, and they can have a, you know, a sandbelt type characteristic in their plant palette and not be in the sandbelt.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the landscape plan that's been put together, and Harley Cruz has really done an amazing job putting that together. It's exciting to see how different that golf course could look, but also how well it could have an identity and how it can be unique to that part of Australia, and it can have plants that make sense and belong there, and not be contrived.
Yeah.
I think that's really exciting, and it will look, I hope it will look very different from what people are used to seeing from Royal Sydney.
Yeah. It was quite a frustration. So I did some work for Royal Sydney in the early stages after they had got the members approval for the work. This is early 2020, but before it had gone to local council, and there'd been some noise from neighbours about the tree removal. And these are people who are saying, oh, it's about the environment and you can't be removing all these big trees. And exactly that argument that, A, these are not trees that were ever meant to be in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. They're not indigenous. They don't have biodiversity value, whether it's flora or fauna. Here's what we're planning. It's actually better for the environment. It's going to be better for, as you say, bugs and insects and animals and flowers and plants that are borderline extinct in the eastern suburbs and should be flourishing if we hadn't intervened. And then ultimately it comes back to these neighbors saying, well, we just like looking at big tree canopies. Ultimately, like, all of the initial arguments they make against what Royal Sydney was planning to do, you know, are completely full of hot air. But then the reality is, we actually don't care about that stuff. We just want to look at big trees. And it's a shame that those compromises needed to be made. But again, it comes back to the practicalities of, to get the approvals that were needed, you know, your option isn't do the perfect version or do nothing. It's like, you can do the compromise version or it's going to be nothing. You know, that ideal version might be ideal. And it frustrated me because I felt like the club had done the right thing for the right reasons, engaged the right people. But in the end, you know, unless you're going to get that approved and be able to build it, you know, you may as well build it in a video game and call it a day. So yeah, it's exciting that the club's stayed the course and the members have had faith and you guys have hung in there as well, because obviously you're very busy. It's exciting now that that's going to get built. And it's kind of an exciting time, I guess, for Sydney golf generally, because Royal Sydney's doing a complete rebuild starting, you know, this summer. New South Wales Golf Club's doing tees and greens and a massive amount of aesthetic and vegetation work starting the summer after. I know Ogilvy, Cocking and Mead are presenting to the Lakes members very soon on some smaller but probably not insignificant changes. It's really all those clubs are making big moves at the same time. And I think Royal Sydney probably now would be fourth or fifth in the pecking order. And I mean, I feel like if you guys get it all right, there's a potential that people might be saying, what's better out of New South Wales and Royal Sydney? And that's a massive turn for the books in Royal Sydney's favour.
I mean, that's a pretty high bar. And like, obviously we're up for the challenge and we want to take it on. And I think I always think it's exciting when multiple golf courses are thinking about work on the same sort of wavelength, really. You know, in terms of Royal Sydney, sort of just driving this project and keep like the club driving this project, I mean, and like with the sustainability focus and with the biodiversity focus and like understanding that these are the broad scale changes that they want to make. And then like, let's make the golf course as good as we possibly can and take the time to do it right. I think that's a winning formula. And then it's just a matter of like when we start digging holes in the ground and we start moving earth, it's just, you know, taking the time and hopefully everything sort of falls into line. Yeah, and I really hope it turns out to be the best it possibly can. And that, I mean, that's every day as a shaper and architect. It's like just make as many good decisions as you can and then try again the next day and hope that you just continually to build, you know, strong golf holes and unique golf holes and great golf experiences for people. And that's all, you know, we hope for every day.
So in terms of building the best golf course you can on that land, how crucial was it to get up to that corner where currently 6, 7, 8 are, to get up there on both nines? It always seemed unfortunate that you cruised through that land in the first hour and a half and then it was behind you. Was that always a key mission for you guys in building the new course?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always unfortunate when all the best land is taken by one stretch of golf holes. And so trying to switch that around and try and revisit those boundary holes, you know, sort of somewhat evenly between the nines just to try and spread it out was a big objective for us. And the routing that we currently have, I think, does a really good job of like getting up and in there and back down a couple of times and playing down off it on different angles. And you know, I think that was a big part of like unlocking how we make the routing work.
Yeah. And I think even to turning that seventh hole currently into, I think it's a short 4 and a 3 in your plan. Yeah. And just so slowing the golfer down as they move across that land, so they spend more time on it versus one par five. It's, I think, going to be something that golfers, maybe they haven't consciously realized when they finish a round at Royal Sydney and they're kind of like, the start was good. It's because of that land through that corner, which, you know, all the best sort of features and holes. That fifth green's great. The drop shot little par three that you're sort of keeping the tee in green location of at the sixth. There's so much good golf to be had there. And it's really exciting that, you know, at the moment there might be 3 or 4 holes and there's going to be, you know, 5 or 6 and spread throughout the round. That's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know who told me this once and it definitely wasn't Killer Jim, but it's like, you know, when you're routing a golf course, if you're on the ocean, you're not going to put back-to-back par fives on your ocean frontage, right? You want to try and incorporate shorter holes and maximize everybody's interaction with the ocean. And I think the same can be kind of said with this routing. We've got a really compelling, you know, section of property with broad-scale movement and opportunity for, you know, multiple good green sites. So we're going to try and take as much of that as we can. And then we kind of stretch a little bit more out on the sort of simpler, flatter land, and we'll use more of the architectural sort of tricks that we have to make those holes compelling and, you know, increase angles and variety of the tee shots and questions we're asking. Just try and maximize the variety in the golf hole and the experience. Yeah.
You were involved in construction at Ahupi as well, from memory?
Yep.
That's unfortunately a course that not a lot of Australians are going to see, but I've always found it an intriguing course from the initial stages of reading about it and then seeing photos of it and hearing the stories from people who have played it. That has to rank as one of your favorite jobs, I suspect.
I mean, yeah, Ahupi is a truly special place. And, you know, it's one of those perfect storms where a lot of things lined up really well. The concept, the ownership, you know, the contractors and methodology, 40 feet of basically USGA grade sand to build out of, and you know, everything was amazingly timed out, and it really came together quite well. It's in the middle of nowhere. You sort of go down these crazy dirt roads to find it, and in construction it was even more in the middle of nowhere than now. And it's definitely going to go down as one of the most significant projects of my career so far. You know, it's always tough when you're like walking off, and I hadn't been working for Gill and Jim that long. And I'm like, well, this may be hard to get better than. And I hope it does. But it's a really special place. And I think what it has turned into post-construction has only taken it to even higher levels. The experience that the golfer has there and the mentality of playing there and being match play only. And I think they do a very good job of really encouraging you to be in the mindset of playing a hoopie and not playing your golf on this golf course. And I think that is a really important part of making a model like that work. Like you can't keep a handicap. You can't really keep score. You just play a match. And if you buy into that, I think then the whole concept works really, really well. And so they do a good job of encouraging that. But to also answer your question, it's very different as like a shaper. You know, you map your progression in different ways, and like often you remember projects for the relationships you build, or you know, certain elements of what you experienced during that job. And you know, that was a good job in the middle of nowhere. It was remote and there was great camaraderie. But you know, there's other jobs where you have long-time friendships from a small renovation you did, and I'll always think back of X job and be like, that was amazing. I wish I could go back to those days because I was living in Brooklyn and working here or whatever it would might be. So yeah, again, another kind of like waffling answer for you, but
it's you interesting know, it, how that, what goes yeah. on behind the scenes. Your experience of a job isn't the critical acclaim afterwards if people like it or whatnot. Your experience yeah. of it is exactly right. What was your relationship with the client like? How was the crew on site day to day? Was it enjoyable? And I guess it's true even when you're playing golf. Like you, people often say, would you rather play Augusta National on your own or you know, some muni with your three, you know, your three best mates? And mm-hmm. I think we all go through phases where we go from Augusta on our own, please, to now. You know, I just won't play golf if I'm not playing with someone that I'm interested to play with because, you know, there's other demands and whatnot. And yeah, I can imagine that people must look at the highlight courses you've been involved in and say, well, they must be the highlights of your career. But is there an example of a project you've worked on that people don't gush to you about, but when you think back on what you've done, you're most kind of proud or satisfied with?
I mean, it's a good question. To me, like the most significant project I've worked on so far is Sleepy Hollow, like to me personally. And like Sleepy Hollow is also a very special golf course and people do gush about that one as well. But, you know, for me, it was a really amazing time in my life personally. And it was a great time in my career that I had a lot of responsibility for the first time and a lot of those things. And so when I think back at that project, that was just a very big part of like why I love working there every day. I was really lucky to work at Merion, and working on bunkers at Merion is like actually nerve-wracking and terrifying. There's so much pressure, but the best part about that job was that I spent basically every day working side by side with either Gil or Jim or one of their mentors, Bill Kittleman, and to just like a vertical learning curve for like 9 months straight and just absorbing all that was amazing. And that takes a, you know, the shaping takes a backseat to those experiences. I was talking to somebody the other day about this. It's almost like when you talk to someone who's been on a massive trip traveling and they're like, oh, I saw you, you know, you went and saw this site. And you know, how was that? And you're like, yeah, that was really cool. Like we went there and we saw the site and it was fine. But down the road, we had the best day ever. Like, you know, and we had a great meal at this place. And that's kind of like how I can maybe relate to what it's like traveling all over the place building golf courses. Is that yes, there's a claim to some stuff that we do and we're very lucky for that, but what I remember is the experiences and like the side stuff that goes on around shaping. And
yeah,
that's what takes a job from being very cool to like memorable forever.
My wife and I took our kids to Europe. We lived in London before we had kids, so we took them over in 2019 to meet our friends in London and whatever. We traveled. And we went to all these, as you describe, all those places that it's like, oh my God, you went to X for an adult. And we're flying home and we asked our five-year-old, like, what was the best thing? What did you think was the best thing? And she said, oh, the best thing was that all four of us were together for a whole month.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, when you when you really cut down to your experience, yeah, as you've just described, it wasn't working in the bunkers at Merion. It was being in the bunkers at Merion with Jim and with Gil and with Bill Kittleman. Like,
yeah,
you could have been in the bunkers at any course in Philly. The experience that meant something to you was that interaction and that learning curve that they gave you. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm so lucky and I'm fortunate. We've been on this crazy wave and I've been so fortunate to be able to ride it. But when I look back at all the fond memories, it's the golf courses that we build and the places we go, but it's always the people that you meet and you hang out with. And like, you know, at Cabot, when I think about like my time as a hand laborer on Cabot Cliffs, like one of the first things I think about is just like, we would take lunch someday sitting on the edge of the bunkers or on the 16th tee, just eating a sandwich, looking at the ocean. I was like, we weren't talking about golf or anything. We're just hanging out. And it's like, it was beautiful when a bunch of people that were happy to do that. You know, the more of that you get, I think the happier you are in life, right?
I suspect you'll be uncomfortable with what I'm about to say, but I think you're being extremely humble saying that you've been on this amazing wave and you're fortunate to ride it. A lot of the people I've talked to, you know, that I've asked about, you know, before we've done this interview, well, the way that they describe it is that sort of you are the wave, that so much of what has been done, you know, obviously the whole crew does what they do and Gil and Jim are the figureheads, and I don't expect you to take as much credit as people say you deserve, but you know, the description from people who have worked with you or been members at places you've worked and seen what you've created is that you sort of are the wave. And that's pretty incredible for a guy who didn't even like golf really till he was 21. It's a pretty remarkable ascent, really.
Yeah, you're right. I'm definitely not going to take that compliment. I mean, it's very sweet to say, but I think, you know, one thing that I'm very fortunate is that I work with two guys that give us a lot of trust and they give us a lot of leeway and a lot of opportunity to run with ideas. And hopefully if you were to ask, you know, anyone in our shaping team or, you know, Kevin Murphy, you know, the other design associate in the company, is like, when you are given an opportunity to like learn, but also like, you know, express yourself and have a go at it, like that's when the fun stuff happens. And then when you're fun and you're happy, you're loving it, you know, everything kind of keeps, you know, snowballing in the right ways. And so, you know, the more I've you know, worked with Gil and Jim, the more responsibility I've had. It has been really fun to like, you know, take a project and run with it and like, you know, going from like, hey, would you like to build a bunker here, to like, hey, here's a golf hole, have fun, you know, or now run an entire project. And like, I think that's been super fun to be a part of. And, you know, I will not take any credit for, you know, the success the company has, because those guys work so hard and they're so great at what they do. But, you know, I think one of the best parts about the way they do things is to give people trust and time and the opportunity to make mistakes and learn from them and then be better the next time. And I think that makes all of us better, which makes the company better. So it's like, you know, hopefully it just keeps driving us forward. And I think the results are kind of there and the momentum's there still.
I had one last question just related to Australia, Ben, before we let you head out, because you've been very good with your time. When you travel back to Australia, when you make your infrequent or probably all too short trips back home, are there a number of courses on your hit list that you want to see, places that you want to go? What's top of mind for you?
I mean, how good is Australian golf doing? Just like, it's awesome. Every time, you know, we had another year ticks by, there's something else that's really great that I really want to see. You know, I was really fortunate to spend a bit of time with Mike Cockey and Ashley around Peninsula Kingswood when it was in construction, but I haven't seen that finished. I haven't seen anything on King Island. You know, I saw 7 Mile Beach raw. I'd really want to see that finished. You know, and Australian golf is just, we're really doing great. People ask me all the time, like, what makes Australian golf so good? It's like, well, Australians do. Like, the way that we kind of approach things makes Australian golf great. You know, there's kind of this no fuss stuff. And when we want to do something, we want to do it right. And now I've got, you know, there's 5 golf courses I've just listed there that I really want to see it's Sandy Links. I want to check out. There's a bunch going on, and I want to check them all out. But unfortunately, when I'm home, it's mostly family time and seeing my folks and getting as much of that in as I can. But yeah, I mean, I'm just stoked for Australian Golf. It seems to me we're making a lot of really good decisions, and a lot of exciting projects have happened in the last 5-10 years, and there's a lot planned. And you know, hopefully people keep getting opportunities to try and to do great work.
Well, it sounds like someone's going to get an opportunity to do great work at Five Mile Beach in the near future. And
I mean, how I just think that that whole project's so exciting. I mean, I love that you can be on a public great golf course 5 minutes from 10 minutes from an airport. Mm-hmm. You know, Matt's got a great sense of how things are going. He's the vibe seems awesome as it is. You know, I'm really excited to see that whole development take off. And I just feel like Australians are going to devour it just like they did when Bumboogle first opened, and it, even more so that it's probably easier to get to. You know, fingers crossed for everything that's happening in Australia. But I think that place is, it's got a lot of people talking, and over here I get asked about it every week. You know, what's going on there? It looks great. It looks different. But if we're talking about a golf course 5 minutes from Hobart in Nashville, Tennessee, I mean, I think that's a pretty amazing sign right there.
Yeah. Feels like a good place to leave it. Thank you so much for your time and for the chat. It's been incredible to hear from you about your career and your views on golf and the industry. It's been really special.
No, thanks so much, guys. This has been fun, and